You're on board KCAA's Inland Talk Express. KCAA, Loma Linda, 1050 AM, the station that leaves no listener behind.
This episode of the House of Mystery is brought to you by Legacy Food Storage. The best way to protect your family is by being prepared. LegacyFoodStorage.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
6.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, Mr. Dave Baseball Martino.
I'm back again.
You're back again.
Back again.
Still rolling.
That's right.
I still can't get the high pitch on my voice yet. Still not back to normal.
Oh, so you're still not feeling great?
Well, you know, it's get better every day, but I just notice when I go to say something, my mouth said something different.
Ah.
It's not following my directions.
Yeah, that's going to be your excuse.
Yeah, that's, you know. And, of course, we're all ready now. They've got a new drink out for spring. It's the cinnamon sweet cream cold brew from Starbucks. But, you know, the problem with that one is I can't do that. I'm too old now. Afternoon, and it's the extra caffeine.
Oh, no, it'll keep you up all night.
Yeah, just a regular one keeps me up. Never mind this. It's like, what do they want me to do with this? So I'll just push this aside and forget about that. And anyway, that would, so we'll talk more later, because I guess you've got a movie review, I'm sure, after the show. Movie for us to avoid watching. Because there's not much on anymore, you know.
No.
Yeah, too many, you know.
Avoid them all.
Too many channels. I'll go back to Perry Mason. I'm in chapter 5, so anyway. Well, today we are going back in time. You know, of course, we've got a writer on that's kind of, we'll talk historical fiction, I guess, is kind of a good way of categorizing it. And the book, of course, is called The Deadliest Deceptions, and it's a collection of Miriam Bat Isaac short stories. Now, the writer is with us. And that's June Trope. Thank you for being here.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me. But I do have something to say to Dave before we get too far away from that. Dave, when you get a little bit older, you can drink all of those Starbucks drinks you want, and nothing will keep you up.
It mixes with his whiskey.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, he's a mess. He never goes to bed.
No.
Terrible.
Up all night.
June. Now, you've written a few books here, and you seem to focus a lot on historical time and Rome and that. Do you know where your interest came from this?
Yes, I do. Although Rome occupied Alexandria, my stories all take place in and around Alexandria, Egypt, 2,000 years ago. I've always been interested in the Roman era, but I was particularly drawn to Alexandria because of a woman who lived there 2,000 years ago, and her name was Maria Hebraea. My background is in chemistry. I had many courses in chemistry before I ever heard of Maria Hebraea, who was For 1,500 years, the most celebrated woman in the Western world for her work in alchemy. I discovered her, accidentally you might say, because I was taking a course on the historical development of concepts in chemistry.
I thought it was Liz Taylor.
Yes.
Well, Alexandria, isn't that where the queen, the pharaoh, was buried?
Oh, yes.
You know, out to sea somewhere. Isn't she, they don't know really where she is, I think, to this date. Isn't it something like that?
Right. They don't. And other important people at that time, I'll call it from Ptolemy's time in ancient Egypt, they were buried in Alexandria. There was a place, a building, a beautiful building, that was essentially their tomb, filled with funereal objects. And there are all different stories about how the different tombs were invaded to take out the gold and run the business of the city of Alexandria. But Miriam had nothing to do with that. She's my protagonist, and neither did the woman I modeled her on, Maria Hebraea. You see, nobody had heard of Maria Hebraea at her time because she was an alchemist, and alchemy was forbidden. The practice was regarded by the emperors as a capital offense, and so while all the mystical arts kept their findings secret, she and her colleagues were especially careful not to record in their time who they were. But she did come to be, as I said, very famous. She was somebody I had never heard of, in part because chemistry is taught from the perspective of contemporary knowledge. No one goes back and teaches how the concepts evolved. But I did take a course on the historical development of concepts in chemistry. Despite all the years I had studied chemistry, though, not only had I never heard of her, I had no idea how any of the concepts evolved. So when the professor assigned a paper to us on a historically significant concept, I had no idea what to write about. The time was ticking away, and I became ever more nervous because I couldn't think of a topic. I decided in desperation to go to the university library stacks and see if anything struck me. And that's exactly what happened. Something struck me.
Something struck you?
I had raised my eyes to the heavens for inspiration. And I was a little anxious. There were some tears there, so they were a little blurry. And I didn't realize I bumped into a bookcase, and a heavy book fell out of the shelf onto my foot and opened up to a page about Maria Hebraea. Well, I was absolutely startled. First of all, my foot hurt like the dickens, but I did pick up the book, and here I saw an article about a woman who, as I told you, was famous not only after her time, she was a secret during her time, but about 400 years after her time, she was discovered, and she was written about and famous through what I would call the scientific revolution of about the 1600s. So that's how I happened to find out about her, and I wrote the paper about her, of course. But 30 years later, after I retired, I resurrected my memory of her. Actually, I'd never stopped thinking about her whenever I'd stop for a red light or wait my turn at a checkout line. I'd wonder what it was like for her when she had to elbow through a crowd along the main boulevard of Alexandria in the first century of the Common Era. I'd even pretend that I was Maria Hebraea. I tried to feel the morning sun on my back, as she must have felt it. Perhaps she even had to elude a camel caravan, a curtain litter, or a groaning ox cart, but all I could conjure up was the traffic on 42nd Street.
Yeah, I think I've seen you in the store.
So, she was perfect for me because nothing was known about her. I could invent anything about her I wanted, and here I had a protagonist who was intelligent and intrepid. So she was perfect. She was just like Nancy Drew, who I'd read about as a kid. She and Nancy Drew risked their lives for their craft and guarded the secrecy of their work. So I had the perfect protagonist for a mystery series.
Well, I'm wondering, you mentioned Maria Hebraea. Even though she was kind of unknown, she became famous. How did that happen? How did she get rediscovered?
Well, she was rediscovered because, although she wasn't known personally, her inventions were very important to the field of alchemy. And I'll even mention to you, because I believe that you know of one of her inventions. She invented the double boiler. Everybody who's melted chocolate in the kitchen knows about the double boiler and is profiting from the discoveries of Maria Hebraea. But of course, never mind your love for chocolate, especially in Starbucks. I'm thinking about Dave right now. I'll bet you get those chocolate cappuccinos. But aside from the double boiler, she also invented the distillation apparatus, and that has been used for millennia. Every chemistry student uses it now to create some kind of concoction, but it was she who invented it. And of course, we know about distilled liquor, and that, of course, the distillery is big business today. So that's how she came to be known, through her inventions. But very little, as I said before, could be found out about her. So I decided to make her my protagonist. I changed her name to Miriam Bot Isaac, and I created a family for her. I gave her a twin brother who was a fierce athlete. He became a famous gladiator, so I could use the gladiator business as a piece of my stories. And she had a tyrannical father who coerced her into choosing duty over desire. And I gave her a servant girl who was 5 years her senior, and her name was Phoebe, who became her best friend and sidekick. So that's how I was able to invent Miriam Bot Isaac out of Maria Hebraea.
How close to the original character do you stick with? I mean, obviously, I guess there's only so much you can really find out about the true original Maria, because so much was so secret. I guess didn't they consider like alchemy or chemistry and all that? Wasn't that kind of almost witchcraft in a sense?
Yes. The emperor said it should be punished by death because he was afraid the alchemists, in synthesizing gold, would undermine his currency and overthrow the empire. So that was one reason that it was forbidden. Only later, though, did it become associated with witchcraft. In the beginning, alchemy was really a legitimate forerunner of chemistry. It was based on Aristotle's principles, so it had a different theoretical framework. But it was the forerunner of chemistry because it was an experimental science. And it was actually concerned with much more than just synthesizing gold. The idea of Aristotle was that all materials are essentially the same, whether they be metals or even living things like human beings. So my alchemist, Miriam Bot Isaac, was particularly interested in improving human life, improving, I'd say rejuvenating human life, making human life better, free from illness, more than a direct interest in synthesizing gold. But Alan, it was a legitimate science. Only later on was it turned into some kind of charlatan-based witchcraft. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you, Isaac Newton himself wrote well over 1 million words about alchemy, although he kept it a secret, not so secret because he was famous. But by the time of Isaac Newton, Aristotle's theories weren't the prevailing framework for interpreting chemistry.
So obviously you started with characters. The character were the primary start of your stories, of this series. What came next? Was it the plot, a story, or was it actually the setting?
Well, it actually was plot. I had the character, but plot was most important to me at the beginning. Plot was most important to me because I wanted to write mysteries. And so I had to manipulate the plot so on one hand I could protect the identity of the perpetrator, but on the other hand give a fair experience, a satisfying experience to the reader. So they should be able to have a fair chance with clues to figure out who the perpetrator was. So I really did emphasize plot. At the same time, you see, that I started, that I found out about Maria Hebrea, I put her in the back of my mind. I was working full time. I certainly didn't have time to write mysteries. But writing a mystery was an objective of mine almost from childhood. You see, I had a life of crime, even as a little girl when I was 8 years old. I was in fifth grade, and the girl sitting next to me was reading a Nancy Drew mystery. So after I borrowed hers, I swallowed up all the other mysteries that I could read and eventually graduated to Agatha Christie, and then to Sherlock Holmes, and then to the latest ones. By the time I read Sherlock Holmes, I had honed my observation skills, and I wanted to be a detective. I looked for crimes to solve in my neighborhood. They seemed to fall out of the sky for Nancy Drew. I looked for secrets to unravel, puzzles to explain, but to my dismay, no mysteries materialized, not as they had for Nancy or Sherlock Holmes. So I didn't know what to do with my life. I had dreamed of being a detective. And in my time, when I came of age, women did not become detectives. So I had to, finally, after I retired, become a writer of detective stories. That's how I made the leap from Maria Hebrea to Miriam Bot Isaac to write the stories.
How much, you must do a tremendous amount of research with the time and the placing and Alexandria and what it would have been like to live there and work and be in the community. Just they must have had a totally different lifestyle, different things that they did. It must have been, how much time does that take to put that together?
I would say that I've done research for 15 years, and I never know, first of all, that's fun to me, but I never know what I'm going to research. Now, Alexandria was a famous city, especially in the first century, a great deal. I couldn't possibly read everything that was written about Alexandria. And likewise, when my Miriam takes her trips, she goes to other cities that were very well known. Most recently, she went to Ephesus. And because the Apostle Paul went to Ephesus in the first century of the Common Era, there's so much written about it. The buildings, the floor plans, the architecture, everything is so clear in my mind. So many papers are written about all the places Paul went to in Ephesus and where the emperors went as well, all of the famous people. Remember in Alexandria, there was the medical school and the great library. All these places have been written about. The landmarks are so clear. So I picked a city that was easy to research. On the other hand, I found very difficult things to research. One of my stories has a viper that gets loose. And while I was a student of biology and a serious student, I never remembered studying the locomotion of a viper on a marble floor. Well, I had to know that in order to do my story. And then, just a few days ago, I was researching the Roman view of tattoos. You know, now, tattoos are really de rigueur. They're considered cool. They're considered in fashion. But I got into tattoos because, as I told you, my Miriam's brother became a gladiator. And gladiators, among prisoners of war and slaves, and some soldiers were tattooed. So I wanted to research how the Romans felt about tattoos. They were not works of art. They were not considered anything but functional. If anything, they were badges of shame. So the idea of tattoos, I had to research just the other day for the sake of Miriam's brother. I never know what I'm going to research, and I never stop.
Well, how do you get into the minds of your historical characters, since they lived so long ago? Are you pulling from the historical record, or is it all imagination? How do you do that?
A lot of it is imagination. But I have to say, Dave, that people are still people, and there's still such things as greed and murder and love and choices, wealth and poverty, pestilence. There's urban blight. Alexandria was a splendid city, but it had its pestilential districts where there was pigeon dew crusted on the water fountains. It was there was graffiti smeared all over. It was not so very different, really. I did study graffiti during the Roman Empire, too. A completely different view of graffiti than there's graffiti now. But anyway, certain things about humans have not changed. And that's why I think my books are appealing to modern readers. While they're visiting an exotic place and becoming familiar with the culture, they're at the same time seeing into the raw innards of human beings.
When you're writing one of these books and someone takes it home and reads it, there's so much to take in, you know, learning the city and the atmosphere and the vibrations, the story, the characters. What is it you hope they take away from the book? Is it something more than entertainment?
Oh, yes. I want the reader to see that justice prevails in the end. And I want them to see that human character and all its foibles hasn't really changed over the millennia. Miriam is motivated by justice, and she pursues it. She pursues it so diligently. It's that important to her that she risks her very life. I want them to see that justice is that valuable.
How do you know when the book is done? Like, how do you, with so much going on and stuff, how do you know, or what is it that makes you realize that it's completed?
Okay. Writing a novel is very much an art embedded in the fads and fancies of our day. I write a contemporary novel. If you read contemporary mysteries, for example, you'll see they're very different from the ones written even 100 years ago. Readers had more time then. The whole style of unfolding a story was different. I'm just thinking now of David Copperfield, which was one of my favorite books. But the language, the erudition in the language, was different style. It was written for the highly literate class that had plenty of time to cozy up at the end of the evening and take their time in letting the story unfold. Today, writing a commercial, popular novel isn't like that. The woman who's picking out the book is in the bookstore. Her three-year-old is jerking on her skirt. The money has run out of the meter. She's in the bookstore. She has to pick up something fast, and she'll read maybe the first page, if you're lucky. Maybe she'll just read the first paragraph. The whole style of writing today is the book has to get off the ground very quickly with an inciting incident. And not only that, but the book follows the popular fad. It has a particular story arc. So even though your story is unique, it follows the fashion of writing a book of that genre. And so with the story arc, you kind of know the pattern of how to pace your story.
So what are your influences? How do you gain influences to write historical fiction?
I would put it this way, Alan. It's how do I get an influence, a nudge, to wash the dishes, make the beds, serve the supper, clean up, make a grocery list, and fold the laundry. I'm willing to cheat on all those things because all I want to do is escape. I want to escape it all. I want to escape this world. I want to escape into the world of Alexandria. So it's not hard to get me behind the computer. It's hard to get me in front of the stove.
Oh, so basically you have nothing cooked, your dishes are dirty, your house is a mess.
I have a pagoda of dirty dishes in my sink.
I could see this now, you know. Get the laundry done.
Sounds like me.
There are days I don't even comb my hair. I just roll out of bed and I can't wait to see what happens next. My characters tell me, you know, I know them very well by now. I've been visiting them, and they've been visiting me for 15 years. I know them very well, and they talk to me now. I play with them now. They're my friends now. I know this sounds a little crazy, but especially during COVID, I didn't have any other friends. The only ones who visited me were my characters.
Why don't you get them to do the dishes?
Well, you know, you're saying you can hear your characters. Do they ever surprise you? Do they ever just kind of go off the rails and just take the plot wherever they want it to go? Or is that are you in more control?
There are two kinds of writers, of course. We're all a mixture. But one extreme is called the pantsers. They fly by the seat of their pants. They don't know what they're going to write about that day. They just wait for that inspiration. And then there are the plotters. I have always been a plotter. I plot everything. Well, I was a teacher. You could never walk into a junior high school classroom and just work off the cuff. My goodness, you better have that carefully plotted. So, I am a plotter by nature, but as I've come to know my characters more and more, I listen to them more and more, and I do fly by the seat of my pants a little bit. I let them tell me. What happens is I have a plan for them, and I see it's really totally out of their character. And so they tell me that, and they put me in their place. They won't do that. So it happens, but not so very often, and certainly not at the beginning. I hold on very tight. That's who I am.
How does that develop, that kind of, I don't know what you call it, that kind of creativity with characters that you write about?
I don't really know where it comes from. I don't really know where it comes from, how I know them, except I have to say, I was very imaginative as a child. My mother used to say to me, and these were her exact words, "June, you've got too much imagination for your own good." That's when she was hollering at me, because maybe I did tell my fair share of fibs. So I've always had an imagination. My sister says, and by the way, I have a twin sister, which is why I gave Miriam a twin brother. My twin sister, whom I've been through so much of my life with, she and I both had a difficult childhood. I think everybody, by the way, has a difficult childhood in one way or another. Being a child is very difficult. You have no autonomy. But we had a difficult childhood, and my sister says the way I adapted was that I always made things up. I always lived in my own world. I made up my own world. So in that sense, it wasn't anything new for me. I did it to survive, and I just continued to do it as an adult when it wasn't so necessary anymore.
So let's talk about one of the key things I think is important, because we talk about your main protagonist being alchemist, and we talked about chemistry and all that stuff. But because you do have a murder case involved, you've got crimes and things going on, how do you resolve, or how do you talk about or explain what kind of policing as well as forensics and investigations that they had in Alexandria back at that time?
Well, they didn't have police. The soldiers acted as police. Alexandria was crawling with Roman soldiers. So they didn't have police, but they did have a few trained investigators, very few. I guess now I have to tell you that the Romans didn't regard murder the same way we do today. If the people, even citizens, Roman citizens, wanted to kill each other, that was really their own business. And while you might find that hard to believe, let's look at the way they regarded human life. Certainly there were more slaves than citizens. Gladiators, the ring was a brutal place. They didn't have the same regard for human life that we have. But Miriam does. Now, Miriam, to be an alchemist, I should tell you, the only alchemists at that time were Jews, and she was an observant Jew. She followed Torah law, and so she learned to value human life in spite of the ambient culture. Now, Alexandria was culturally complicated because you did have Jews there. They had special privileges. They lived in their own neighborhood, although it wasn't a ghetto and they didn't have to live there. But you also had Greeks. It was a Greek city. Alexander the Great was Greek. And then you had the Romans. It was also a stop on the Silk Road. So you had the infusion of a lot of Asian ideas. So we have this melting pot. But the Romans were the rulers. They occupied the city, and they didn't really value human life. The only times they did were, for example, if a slave tried to kill his master, then all of the slaves owned by the master were crucified. Otherwise, it was only prisoners of war and other people who might be practicing alchemy. They would be killed. But we don't think of murder in Roman times the same way we think about it today, except Miriam cared. And while some of the books, most of the books, deal with murder, they also deal, some of the stories deal with theft. And so in one of my books, The Temple of Artemis had the treasury of the entire city of Ephesus, and that was looted. Eventually, when the thieves had so much wealth, of course, they were subject to being murdered, and I'm not giving much away when I say that they were, but some of the murders were consequential to other crimes, like theft, which certainly did occur.
So they never really had any tests or investigations so much. So like if someone was found dead in a room, they would kind of maybe look it over and, oh, that person was stabbed or poisoned maybe, but they didn't go much further than that then.
They didn't have the tools. They really only had three tools for forensics. And I have to say that the first forensic autopsy was done on Julius Caesar in 44 before the Common Era, which was almost, well, it was a generation before Miriam. That was the first forensic autopsy. They did many autopsies in the medical school to learn anatomy, but forensics wasn't something that they were particularly interested in unless the person who died was very rich or very famous. So, for example, there was the case of dental characteristics. The Romans had terrible teeth. They had terrible teeth because they had a sweet tooth, and they probably didn't have the kind of dental practices, they certainly didn't, that we had, although they did have false teeth and they did do extractions, but not nearly like what we do today with implants, for example. So by the time someone was an adult, they had a unique dental characteristic. They had unique patterns of tooth decay. And so they used that pattern of recognition, if it was somebody famous, to bother to identify who was killed. So, for example, one of the most famous cases of all had to do with Agrippina the Younger. She was Nero's mother, and she was Caligula's wife, I believe. She wanted to marry Claudius. That's really the main thing. She wanted to marry Claudius, and she had a rival. So she sent her slaves to kill that rival, Loli Polina. And then, in order to be sure that her rival was killed, she demanded the head and inspected Paulina's teeth. That's the way she verified that her guard, her slaves, had killed the right woman. But that's an exception. They didn't ordinarily use dental characteristics. They didn't ordinarily use pattern recognition. And they didn't ordinarily use blood spatters. That came much later, and only to the famous. The most famous case with blood spatters is called the Hall of Handprints, if you want to research it. A blind son was accused of killing his father for his inheritance, and investigators saw his blood-spattered hands making intermittent footprints, handprints, intermittent handprints on the wall. He was brought to trial, and his defense attorney said, no, he's blind. He wouldn't have put his handprints intermittently on the wall. He would have dragged his bloody hands along the wall. Instead, the defense attorney accused the blind son's stepmother that she killed her husband for his inheritance, for her inheritance, his money. So these were very wealthy or very famous people. And those are just the few cases. They didn't regularly have much in the way of forensics. They didn't have fingerprints. They certainly didn't have DNA. Now, Miriam had one device, though. She finds a dead body, and she puts her lips to the belly of the corpse. And she does that to test the temperature. She could tell that he had died very recently. And so that enabled her to at least narrow down the suspects.
When you're talking about different people that are real, do you get much detail, or what kind of history do you go by, or how do you decide how you're going to write about Claudius and different characters of the past? Because there's so many different stories about them, you know what I mean?
Yes, and by the way, some terrible things have been written, let's say, about Nero.
Yeah.
But modern historians, some of them, have defended him. And certainly the earlier part of his reign, he did a very good job. The empire really thrived by their standards, of course. So, yes, but there's so much written about them.
Yeah.
Now, I remember I wrote about Agrippina the Younger, and I hadn't really researched her, but I have a beta reader, somebody who knows about the Roman Empire. And in my story, I said, someone opens the door and sees a woman who looks just like Agrippina the Younger and giggled. And my beta reader said, she wouldn't have giggled. She would have gasped. This was a very cruel woman. And indeed she was. So I learned the hard way, you could say, Alan. I learned the hard way that I better do my research about these characters. They are well known. And it's, you know, no excuse that I not learn about them, too.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. It makes for a fuller, especially if someone knows some history.
Yeah.
It, you know, it makes it more realistic. Right.
Right. You know. Right.
So let's talk about how we find June. So June, do you have a website? Do you have social media? Where is it that you like to have your fans and readers interact with you or contact you?
Okay. I have a social platform. I have a website. It's www.junetrope, one word, no E on the end, JUNETROP.com. That's my website. I also have a presence on Facebook, June Trope Author. Separate words, June Trope Author. But I keep in touch with my audience mostly because I post a blog every Tuesday afternoon, Eastern Time. I post a blog about some aspect of life in ancient Alexandria and connect it either with one of my stories or one aspect of life today. Like I'll write about tattoos or graffiti. I think Roman medical practices are very interesting. I write about that, about gladiators. The blogs are short. They're average about 250 words, never go as long as 300 words. But this is a brief chance for my audience to keep in touch with me, to make comments. I get back to them. And every single comment, if you've ever commented, you get a response back from me. So that kind of keeps a lively group going. They know each other because they can read what each other wrote as comments on my blog. And so that's the way I do it.
Well, and fantastic. Now, we're going to have that up on our website as well, as your book, so people can find you real easily. Now, of course, your latest book is called The Deadliest Deceptions. Our guest has been the author of that and many other books. June Trope, thank you very much for being here.
Such a pleasure. Such a pleasure to meet you and Dave. Thank you.
Thanks, June.
We interrupt our programming. This is a national emergency. Important details will follow.
Are you prepared? Legacy Food Storage. The best way to protect your family is by being prepared. Go now to legacyfoodstorage.com. Use coupon code HOM15 now for 15% off. Quick, go!
If you're a fan of stories that make you afraid to turn the lights off at night, then you will love Moonless Nocturne, Tales of Dark Fantasy and Horror. From attorney, former Air Force officer, special agent for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and Bram Stoker award-winning author, Hank Schwebel. Moonless Nocturne is a chilling set of 10 tales that offers an exquisite and impressive showcase of the author's talents that are sure to entertain and intrigue readers who love a good thrill. With an introduction by the iconic F. Paul Wilson, Moonless Nocturne is a gourmet platter of both red meat and rare delicacies, not only for aficionados of horror, mystery, thrillers, and suspense, but any connoisseurs of fantastic fiction. It's inventive and original. This collection has already been optioned for television and film by Lone Tree Entertainment and is certain to appeal to fans of King, Barker, Matheson, and Jackson. It's not the dark that should scare you. It's all the things that lurk there. Order your copy right now on Amazon or wherever books are sold. Moonless Nocturne, Tales of Dark Fantasy and Horror. From author Hank Schwebel.
Now back to the show.
Welcome to Martino Movie Reviews. I'm Dave North Martino. Today we're going to talk about Megan, which is a science fiction horror film. Megan is stylized as M3GAN. So just for your confusion. This review, of course, will be spoiler-free. And before we get into that, I just want to let you know that Amazon will be discounting my book, Wolves of Vengeance, down to 99 cents from 8 a.m. on March 13th to 8 a.m. on March 20th in the U.S. and in the U.K. So if you've ever thought about getting my book, you can grab it then. So, you know, if you go to IMDb, you'll see that Megan is listed as a robotics engineer at a toy company, builds a lifelike doll that begins to take on a life of its own. So that's a fairly decent description and definitely a spoiler-free description. Gives you an idea of what's going to happen. Now, it was directed by Gerard Johnstone. It was written by, I hope I'm pronouncing the name right, Akala Cooper from a story by Cooper and James Wan. And we all know James Wan from his other horror works. Does this live up to his other works? Well, we'll see. We'll see. It stars Allison Williams and Violet McGraw. And Amy Donald portrays the physical Megan, while Jenna Davis provides the voice acting. What I found was that Megan is, you know, it's pretty derivative of movies like Child's Play, from like the 1988 Child's Play, Wes Craven's Deadly Friend, which might be a little bit obscure now, RoboCop, especially with some of the commercials that they do, and even a little bit of Real Steel, if you remember that one with Hugh Jackman. So it is a pretty derivative movie. Is it the worst horror movie I've ever seen? No. No, it's watchable. And, you know, the effects, especially of the Megan AI doll, I think they're pretty well done. Unfortunately, you know, there's tonal shifts. And these tonal shifts, they kind of make you wonder if, you know, are you watching a horror film or you're watching a satirical comedy? These shifts don't really work. And it begins in the early part of the film when we have the opening. And I don't want to, you know, again, I don't want to give any spoilers. This is spoiler free. But like in a lot of horror movies, there's like a stupid thing that happens to create the opening. And you're kind of like, I don't know. I don't know if this really works. And then they have this jarring opening where it gets a little bit confusing. And very quickly it goes back on track. You know what's going on. But there are some silly stuff in this, like some silly commercials, and it's not really much of a spoiler to say that there are Furbies in this movie, right? These things that they have, they're going to show you, these toys, look just like Furbies from 1988. Right? So, okay, great, fine. And that's okay, and it's mildly amusing, but I don't really think they needed to go in this direction. I'll get to that in a second. And, you know, the opening doesn't really relate to the rest of the film. I mean, it does, it needs to happen, but there are probably better ways they could open this up. Maybe they could open it up with a dream sequence or something. That's been done a lot in horror films, but this really, to me, the opening just didn't work. And it sets, I think, a very cynical tone for the rest of the film. And, you know, it doesn't really jibe thematically with what's to come, except for one thing. And again, we're spoiler-free here, so I'm not going to go into that. The film itself is a little bit disjointed, but it's strangely entertaining. And there are many problems in this film. So there's really no emotional core. There's nobody in this film that I felt really emotionally connected to. And I think that's a problem of the screenplay. There's absolutely no compelling reason for Gemma, who's played by Williams, to create Megan. Now, there's a subplot set up about corporate espionage, which could have been interesting. You know, there tends to be in certain films and novels, there tends to be somebody who is, they are a traitor, is what they are. And this works well in film, but nothing's ever done with this. And I feel like there was maybe some other portion of the film left on the cutting room floor that could have been added. And maybe it was cut for time, maybe it was cut for good reason. Now, I really feel the scares in this film are non-existent. Right, I didn't feel scared. Megan didn't seem creepy enough to me. And there are ways to make a doll creepy. Even if you look at Child's Play and how Chucky kind of goes through some stages and has periods of time where, you know, like he's injured and stuff like that. And there's stuff that they could do. Megan is also developed by our robotics engineer, Gemma, played again by Williams, so quickly that you're just like, this doesn't work. We need a longer period of time. And I know with YouTube Shorts and TikTok and all of that stuff that we end up with people today who have a short attention span, if you will.
And I think we don't have to drag it out, but we could take our time, put some more emotion in it, and let it run that way. Now, Allison Williams and Violet McGraw plays the niece in this film. I think their acting really saves the film. I think the acting here is great, especially for a horror film. It's done very well. And I think a lot of things are done well enough that the film is interesting enough that you want to watch it. And I was able to watch it. I didn't shut it off. That happens a lot recently, where I'll be watching a movie and I'll be like, I just don't want to watch this, or I can't watch this, or I'm done. Even with all the film's flaws, it still kind of works. And you know, maybe I go in with some lower expectations when it comes to be a horror film, when it's a horror film. But, you know, it's no match to really any of the films that I've previously mentioned. Those films are better. They're better films. They're more interesting. But this is still not bad. And would I recommend that you watch it? I wouldn't recommend that you don't watch it. You know, if this movie sounds interesting to you, I would say give it a watch. It's worth a watch, and you might like it better than I did. It's streaming on Peacock right now. It's definitely worth taking a look at. Now, I usually go through story doctoring, and I really think that this could have worked better if Gemma, as a character, had lost a child and built Megan to deal with the loss. Now, I know it's a little bit cliche, but the movie is derivative anyway. So I think this would have worked better. It would have given it more of an emotional core. And there would have been more of a reason for Gemma to build Megan. Now, I think they should also lean into the horror and the creepiness of Megan and the surroundings and everything that's happening. And I just don't think a lot of the social satire and humor worked in this film. So I would say in this case, I would remove it or maybe try to rework it. But, you know, besides that, I still, with all of that, I still give it 3 out of 5 stars. I'm David North Martino for Martino Movie Reviews. The full written reviews are up at our website, so I hope you'll check them out.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Southern California's Mindspring, the trifecta of progressive talk in Southern California. The legends you love and the best talk.
KCAA Radio has openings for one-hour talk shows. If you want to host a radio show, now is the time. Make KCAA your flagship station. Our rates are affordable and our services are second to none. We broadcast to a population of 5 million people. Plus, we stream and podcast on all major online audio and video systems. If you've been thinking about broadcasting a weekly radio program on real radio plus the internet, contact our CEO at 281-599-9800. 281-599-9800. You can Skype your show from your home to our Redlands, California studio, where our live producers and engineers are ready to work with you personally. A radio program on KCAA is the perfect work from home avocation in these stressful times. Just type kcaaradio.com into your browser to learn more about hosting a show on the best station in the nation, or call our CEO for details. 281-599-9800.
Miss one of your favorite shows? Don't worry, we've got your radio DVR right here on KCAAradio.com. Log on and listen to any show you want, anytime you want, on KCAA, 1050 AM.
This is Judge Herb Dodell, and our show is called For the People. It's available every Monday at 4 o'clock, 4 to 5, and We'll be talking about all kinds of things pertaining to the law and how it really works from the inside as opposed to the outside. So tune in and learn all you need to know about the legal system and how it works.
It's my station.
ProLogic Radio, the legend you love and the best talk. Progressive talk in Southern California.
We listen to you all the time.
Check us out on Instagram where you can watch videos, see pictures, and listen to audio of all your favorite KCAA shows. That's right. KCAA 1050 AM is now on Instagram. Go get your account.
You're listening to KCAA Loma Linda at 106.5 FM K293 CF Moreno Valley.